And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host this afternoon. Today we're going to hear from Kevin Miller and Don Gotchel of the Tongass Turners. They'll be here to highlight the art of creating functional art with wood. Bob Armstrong and Doug Jones will also be here with a preview of this month's Audubon presentation. And Margie Hamburger will be in the studio with an update of activities at the Juno Douglas City Museum. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music and More coming up at 3 o'clock right here on KTOO News Juno. And if you missed the show at 3 p.m., it will be available at 4 on KRNN.
For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Native women from across the country are leading their tribes in the business world. Many female business leaders and tribal chairs are gathered in Las Vegas for the National Reservation Economic Summit. Our news team spoke with a handful of attendees about the role women play.
I am Julie Joins. Business has still always been a man's world, so it is still difficult, even in Indian country, for the women to get recognized and to find the right opportunities. But I think we have good leaders that are trying to make that change. I know that our former tribe leader, Wilma Mankiller for the Cherokee Nation, she was very instrumental in trying to get the women more recognized in business and leadership roles.
Lorelei Cloud. I think recognizing women in business roles is very important because women are, we're coming up in the world and we're becoming more leaders. There's very few of us and far between, and I think the ones that have done it previously have opened the doors for the rest of us to come into that and to shine and to show women are strong.
My name is Gertrude Brown. Being a new council member, being a woman and being young has been all my challenges that I have faced since I've been on council. I am one of the younger ones on our council. I'm the youngest that's been the chairwoman, the first chairwoman of our Owens Valley Board of Trustees. As a young person, you want to be respectful to your elders, but at the same time, it's having to balance being respectful, honoring them, but also realizing, too, that I wear a different hat as a chairwoman, you know, and having that authority. So it's been a hard time trying to balance that.
My name is Michelle Hicks, Principal Chief of the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Nation. My wife is an entrepreneur. She has an ice cream shop in Cherokee, and I think that as you look at, you know, the opportunities for men, the opportunity is just as equal for women. Of course, society don't always look at it that way, but, you know, there's a lot of smart women out there that, you know, if they've got the capital, they definitely have good ideas, and they definitely have the initiative that if the tribe can help them with resources, then I think you'll see more women, you know, step in and be successful.
One Native woman at the Res 2015 conference recently took a leadership role. Antonia Gonzalez has more.
Clara Pratt is Senior Vice President of the Nova Corporation, which is an IT services provider. Pratt says she stepped into the role with some goals to do more work on economic development, building capacity, and building successful businesses in Indian country. She says growing up, there were not a lot of Native women in business she got to see, compared to other professions like those in the legal field or politics. And she says there's a need to increase numbers in the business world.
When you cut out half the population from a career, you're cutting out half of the good ideas and half of the capacity and half of all these important things. And I think, you know, we bring a different perspective a lot of times to the table. And we've seen that in politics. We've seen it in a variety of different career choices, but also, you know, for the future, to show younger people that there are career options out there that they may not have thought about.
Pratt's career has included working in federal and tribal governments, and her advice to other women is to support each other and not to cut yourself out of any potential career goal.
I don't agree with the notion that you cannot do it all. You know, I hear this thought a lot, well, you have to choose between a career and family, right? And I think that's a struggle that not just Native women face, but I think women who've chosen to be in a professional environment and who have focused on their career, you get this sort of message that you can't do it all. I think you can. I think certain times maybe you're a better mom than you are running your business, and sometimes you're maybe not the best because you couldn't make that soccer game or what have you. But those are choices that, you know, men have had to do for years.
Pratt was named to the leadership role at Nova more than a month ago. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juno afternoon. Before we get started with the interviews this afternoon, Juno Police Department, they have reported that there are multiple accidents all over town due to icy conditions because the weather did blow in here. So traffic on Egan outbound is currently being diverted to Glacier Avenue at the breakwater. So bear that in mind, and just bear it in mind in general that the snow and the ice conditions are a little treacherous, so be careful if you're out and about driving. Kevin Miller and Don Gottschall, welcome to the studio, both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Jamie.
You made it here safely, so that's good.
Yeah, advantage of walking.
You are both wood turners and members of the Tongass Turners, and I guess the most obvious question to start with, maybe, Kevin, with you first, is quite simply, what is a wood turner?
Well, basically, it's a potter that does things on an inverted axis instead of on a wheel and the pot standing upright. We put it on a wood lathe, which spins it, I guess, horizontally, and we just use knives, chisels, to shape the wood to whatever shape is pleasing to us, and make bowls and canisters and miscellaneous different things with it.
And the process is are you home in your own studio? Or are you out in some, how do you do it?
Well, we start in the woods. I prefer to use mostly local wood, although I'll use lumber from other sources as well, but go out and harvest a nice alder or mountain ash, a couple of the best woods around here to turn, and cut them into about 16 to 20 inch lengths, and then cut the log in half lengthwise, and we'll turn a bowl blank out of that and just put it on the bandsaw, turn it round or cut it round to get all the excess wood off that we can, and then we mount it on the lathe and start cutting away.
And Don, how long have you been doing this?
Well, maybe 10 years, and Kevin took me out in his backyard and got a piece of firewood and put it on his lathe and said, go. And then he said, not that, and do it this way. And so he taught me how to hold the tools. And so I've been turning ever since, and I donate about 60 bowls a year to local groups.
Don, I didn't have a chance to see if you had a website or anything, but Kevin, I did take a look at your website earlier today to get a sense for the kind of art that you create here, and I realize it's functional, but beautiful work.
Thank you.
And you said that those are really old pictures, and so yeah. I'm assuming you've continued with your craft, and I mean, so gorgeous bowls of and beautiful colors of wood and different descriptions of wood, and so how long have you been doing this?
I first did turning back in high school about 3 million years ago. And
here in Juneau?
Yes, JDHS back in probably 73, 74, whatever year I was taking wood shop. And really liked the process, but then, of course, you get out, go off to college and various wanderings throughout the globe, and didn't really pick it up again until around 97 or so. It had a house with a garage that I could put a lathe in, and just like woodworking in general, and so kind of slowly started picking it up there, and just been doing it pretty much ever since. Do it in my spare time. I have day job, but it's a fun hobby, and it and it pays its own way. I sell my stuff at the Bear's Lair downtown.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody wants to see anything live, they're welcome to go down there and take a look. And like Don, I also like to support favorite charities such as K2 and their spring or fall auction. I've been known to donate a bowl or two. And so, yeah, just like that.
Don, the Tongass Turners, it's a group.
Right.
Talk about the group. Tell
okay.
folks about it.
We're a group of wood turners with varying levels of skills. And we meet every second Saturday of the month out at Thunder Mountain High School. And 9 to 12. And anybody's welcome to come. And we have all kinds of levels. Some of us are, I'm more of an intermediate turner. We have beginning turners and some really expert turners, some people who do a lot of art, may make jewelry, and some of the people have a lot more tools than others of us. And occasionally on Saturday morning, we help students out there doing basic turning out there.
How big is the group, the Tongass Turners group?
Well, we got maybe 15 or 20.
Mm-hmm.
But rarely in the same room at the same time.
And do they all have their own studios? Are they?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, kind of varies as to how much space they have and stuff. Some of them have larger lathes, and you know their garage or their shop is taken up with you know a good number of wood turning tools. And others just have small mini lathes, which you can pick up for $200-$300 that you can fit on a you know small workbench, and you know maybe 2.5 feet long and 10-12 inches high, 6 inches wide. So it's kind of
So your shop, is it a small shop or is it a big shop? Take us on a tour, quick virtual tour of your shop.
Well, the two-car garage, and there's really no room in it to I can park my son's bicycle.
And how does the family feel about this?
Oh, they tolerate it. You know, it's 'twas ever thus, so. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that my wife gets tired of sawdust being tracked into the house and such, but we're never short of kindling to start the fire with.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like I say, pays for itself and everything. So
how many pieces of equipment are in your shop?
Well, in mine, I've got a pretty complete shop. Planers, joiners, bandsaw, table saw, lathe, miscellaneous hand tools, workbench, and drill press, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Don, your shop?
My shop, I use about 2/3 of a basement of a 12-sided house, and I've got about the same tools as he does. I got a bandsaw that can rip 12-inch thick lumber, mm-hmm. you know, 18 inches wide. That's kind of standard. I got an air dust collector. It's real important when you're sanding. And in addition to tools he mentioned, I use like 2 or 3 drills for sanding, the different types of sanding things. If you're not really good, you have to sand more. And if you're working with softwoods, mm-hmm. like I bring a lot of wood in from Canada, like bug-killed pine that's got a blue stain to it. And it's terribly dry up in the Atlant, and you can... And it gives it real different patterns, and it's really a unique wood.
Hmm.
And then I like alder. I like to spalt it, which is means that you let it lay outside in June weather, and it starts to decay, and it changes like from a commons, you know, brown lumber. It goes into black and orange, and with streaks in it, and it actually becomes a fairly exotic wood.
I imagine, and I think I got a glimpse of that on the website, where when it becomes a piece of art, a lot of it is the color and the wood itself,
mm-hmm.
what it brings. So you just mentioned Canada. Do you have people finding wood for you, searching out? Do you get wood, you know, somebody from around the other side of the planet saying, I've got a beautiful piece of wood for you?
Well, I actually, yes, the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
The logger who built my log cabin up in Atlant, he goes out and hunts, and we trade lumber. And he finds me 8, you know, like 8 10-inch diameter willow trees, It's very, very light. It's called popcorn bowls when you make one of them that might be 10 inches in diameter and a quarter inch thick. And you pick it up and it just about flies out of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the favorite woods.
And Kevin, same question. Are you forever searching and seeking out woods? On your website, you had a piece of driftwood that you said, oh, I could have either thrown it on the bonfire or turned it into something beautiful, and I did the latter, and indeed it was something beautiful. So where do you find your wood?
The funny thing about wood turners is they become wood magnets. Once the word gets out,
it shows up.
It does. And I mean, sometimes you have to be just kind of on the lookout, but we were having some good winds the other day, and over there in Marine Park, a rather large limb fell off of an ash tree, and so my office is just across the street, so I ran over to the guys that were doing the cleanup on it, the Parks and Rec crew, and said, can I have that branch? And they said, oh, we're more than happy to give it to you, unless they have to deal with it, right? You know, because they got to take it out and grind it up or burn it or some odd thing, and so we threw it in the back of a friend of mine's truck, and now it's sitting in my driveway waiting for me to get to it. And I've turned a little bit of the ash from those trees before, the other trees that have come down in the park over there, and it's wonderful wood to turn and very different from anything we have growing naturally around here.
I salvaged a limb off of a ginkgo tree in Madison, Wisconsin after a tornado came through last March. And I've flown in wood from Tasmania, Tanzania,
mm-hmm.
and Hawaii. And so you go through customs, and you got these odd 2x6s or 4x12s sticking out of your bags. But you pick it up wherever you can find it.
Got to allow a little extra time for security, I imagine, when you're hauling wood around like that.
Sometimes after they've seen you packing it and weighing it, they just laugh at you and push you through, get you out of the way.
Well, very good. We're coming to the end of our time. So anything else about Tongass Turners that you guys wanted to make sure you mentioned today before we wrap it up?
No. Again, just 9 o'clock, Thunder Mountain High School. Normally, this week we're meeting at a member's house way out at Randall Road out past 17 Mile or so. But normally, Thunder Mountain High School shop, 9 o'clock, and the public's welcome. And doesn't matter if you ever picked up a lathe chisel or not before. You know, we'll have to give you a little tutorage if you need some.
Don, anything to add?
Well, we have a guy named Mike McCrill.
Longtime dentist here in town.
And he's in the phone book, and he kind of keeps track of our work list and so on, our name list and so mm-hmm. on. So you could look him up, Mike McCrill, and
okay.
He'd be glad to give you all the details.
Very
more
good.
Details.
Don Gutschall and Kevin Miller, thank you very much, both of you, for coming into the studio today.
Thank you, Jamie. It's been fun.
Thanks.
Welcome back to a Juneau Afternoon. Before we speak with our next guest, just a reminder, the weather's kicked up and the roads are bad, and Juneau Police Department has reported multiple accidents all over town due to the icy conditions, and traffic on Egan outbound is currently being diverted to Glacier Avenue at the breakwater. So be safe out there driving around. So Bob Armstrong and Doug Jones, both with the Audubon Society, are here in the studio. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And you're here to talk about the Thursday night presentation. So we're talking about tomorrow night, correct?
Correct.
And you have a show entitled Flight to Adventure.
That's the title of the Audubon presentation every month.
Oh, okay.
And then the presentation each month varies. And this particular one, Bob and I are going to do a presentation talking about video. You may want to say something about that, Bob.
So you're both renowned photographers. And, Bob, you've got a bunch of book credits, nature books. And so there's a lot of expertise in the studio today. So tomorrow night's presentation, what do you have planned for the public that shows up?
Well, both of us have been photographers for many, many years. I've been one for over 50 years in Juneau. And about a year ago, we discovered the value of taking videos in nature, and that it seems to be able to reveal much more than what a still photograph can do. And so we've been kind of working together, doing underwater photography with GoPros and setting up remote cameras at bird nests and things like that, and just recording what goes on when we're not there. And it's real exciting to see.
And that's what the public is going to get a glimpse of tomorrow, I'm assuming.
Yes. Each of us will present maybe 15, 20 minutes of fairly short clips of videos, maybe 1 to 2 minutes each.
I assume this is all local. This is Southeast. This is Juneau area wildlife that we're going to see?
Yes, mm-hmm. That's correct.
And maybe just give us a tease here of a kind of clip or a kind of, because when you were describing it, Bob, right away I'm imagining a bird diving into, so give a feel for the kinds of things people might see.
Well, one of my favorite ones, which actually is the first video I ever did, was a beaver attempting to take a log into its house as a pond was icing over. And it's just a wonderful example of the perseverance and patience that beavers have. And I included a song by the Rolling Stones in it called Try a Little Harder, and it just fit perfectly. Anyway, it was very, very much fun to put together.
And so are you wading into the water and putting your head underwater and placing a camera? I mean, give me a sense of how do you get this set up so that it works?
Well, Doug and I often sit out in the weather for a couple hours, because sometimes when we put out cameras, it'll be in the intertidal zone.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to watch them real carefully to make sure we don't lose them. And sometimes they might be in a place where a lot of people go. And other times we just put a camera out underwater and then leave for about 3 hours.
And Doug, have you done, do you work as a team? Are the two of you a team, or are you sometimes out there by yourselves doing
this?
Well,
I think we challenge each other a little bit, and we both learn from each other as we're doing some of these videos. And we both learned, one of the cool things I think we've learned is that if a person is there, it tends to influence what's going on in nature. And we've both discovered that if we can leave the camera, disguise it somehow so nobody will find it and walk away with our gear, leave it and go away, things settle down and things happen that you don't ever see when you're in the area. So it's been fun watching video. Come back, you're all excited to grab the camera and go back to the house and watch the video to see what you got, because sometimes it's pretty surprising. It's fun for both of us. So, yeah, we've worked together. We've worked, learned from each other. I hope he's learned something from me. I know I learned volumes from Bob. He's an amazing guy.
And is this one of those tasks where you go out 100 times and maybe 5 times you get something really good? Or, I mean, I'm assuming this takes a while to come up with something where you go, ah, look at that.
Oh, definitely. I know in trying to get photos of dippers swimming underwater or salmon spawning, sometimes it'll take a dozen or more times out before you capture anything. And we've both tried to get a coho in the spawning act, and we spent hours and hours and hours at it, and we still haven't achieved it.
And are you doing this all seasons? I mean, I'm assuming, you know, winter is winter, so there's probably some limitations there, yet wildlife, of course, is still out and about. Mm. So is this an all-season activity?
It's been year-round, yeah. We're, of course, targeting different things in the winter than we were in the summer or the fall. You know, the salmon are only in a certain time frame, so you're limited to what you can do. But, yeah, there is something going on year-round, and we were out yesterday sitting in the snow and the wind. So, yeah, it's been a continuous effort.
And, of course, you guys like sitting outside in the snow and the wind. Well, outdoor recreation enthusiasts. So tomorrow night, this is a free presentation, correct?
Yes.
And it's tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. This is at the Student Recreation Center at UAS.
That's correct. If you're going up the Loop Road from DeHarts, instead of turning right to go into the university, you turn left to go into the Student Recreation Center.
Mm-hmm. And is this an hour long or an hour and a half? Or?
Yeah, an hour with questions.
Yeah.
Like Bob said, 15, 20 minutes for each of us, and then questions afterwards. So about an hour program is what we're hoping for.
I'm assuming just the kinds of questions you'd be getting, there's a certain amount of science involved with answering these questions. I mean, yeah, people are going to be inquisitive about,
hopefully,
well, what was that animal doing? I mean, what were they trying to do at that moment in time? So this isn't so much you have a full-on presentation with narrative, or is it?
Each video we will try to point out what is happening in there, because sometimes it's not obvious what's going on. Like a Dolly Varden coming up, a male Dolly Varden courting a female Dolly Varden, and what it does during the courtship process is just fascinating, and things you just don't see watching them above water.
And you're gonna help people understand what they're seeing.
Yeah.
Well, I can only imagine it's going to be a really interesting presentation. So before we wrap up talking about that, any other kind of Audubon Society business and events that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, I'd like to mention Patricia Wary is doing a beginner birder course starting later this month. It'll be on the, I think it starts on March 26th. And it's for people that are novices or beginning birders. The class is $37.50, and it is on Thursdays, and you can call Patricia Wary if you're interested at 209-3374. And then starting on April 11th, pretty much every Saturday, we do a bird walk in the morning. So if anybody's interested in going out and looking for birds, there's guided hikes for people to bird watch. And the other thing I'd like to mention is the Berners Bay. We do a Berners Bay cruise every spring, and this year there'll be 2 days, Saturday, April 25th at 8:30, and then on May 2nd we do two cruises, one at 8:30 and one at 1:30. And people can find more information, just search for Juneau Audubon, and we've got a Juneau Audubon webpage. We've also got a Facebook page, so you can look for Juneau Audubon on Facebook if you're interested.
And Bob, for anybody who's not convinced already to attend tomorrow night to see these interesting videos, anything else you'd like to just add in terms of promoting the event?
Oh boy, that's a. I think that one thing that kind of excites me sometimes is putting together a video in nature and then trying to tie a certain song into it. I've only got a couple like that.
And the Rolling Stones is one of them.
One by the Rolling Stones and one by Louis Armstrong, titled Hello Dolly.
Very good. Very good. Well, Bob Armstrong and Doug Jones, Juneau Audubon Society, thank you very much, both of you. First off, thank you for your work, your bodies of work. That's a contribution to Juneau and beyond, so thank you for that and for making this work available to the rest of us tomorrow. Wow. So appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. We're about to hear the song of the gray-breasted wood wren in the mountains of southern Mexico. The song's being sung not by a single bird, but by a mated pair. The two wrens are singing a duet. Each sings a different phrase, but the phrases are so closely linked, we hear it as one song. Such close duet singing in birds is called antiphonal song. The pairs use song to stake out and hold breeding territories. Duetting is most typical of birds, including many tropical wrens, that live in dense habitats. We think close interplay of song reinforces pair bonds in birds that frequently lose sight of each other. Let's slow down the song to 1/4 speed. It'll be easier to hear two separate voices. Bird songs featured on Bird Note come from the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. I'm Michael Stein.
The Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 11th of March, 2015. It was on this day, 1779, the Continental Congress established the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Their job was to put up fortifications and clear terrain before George Washington's army marched through, also to make maps and to dig strategic trenches. Some of them were called sappers, which comes from the French word saper, meaning to dig. They were diggers of trenches and fortifications. In 1802, in fact, Thomas Jefferson established West Point Military Academy for the sole purpose of training engineers. During the War of 1812, the Corps designed a system of fortifications for the New York Harbor, and one of the forts became the base for the Statue of Liberty. In peacetime, the Corps of Engineers worked on infrastructure and exploring the western frontiers, building roads and bridges, lighthouses, military fortifications. And in 1824, Congress authorized the Corps to take surveys of roads and waterways and to improve navigation on the Mississippi and Ohio rivers by removing natural obstacles, snags, and sandbars. It's the birthday of the children's book author Ezra Jack Keats, born in Brooklyn, 1916, best known for his book The Snowy Day, about an African-American child named Peter who goes out exploring his New York neighborhood after the first snowfall of the season. It's the birthday of the poet who said, "Any time not spent on love is wasted," Torquato Tasso, born in Sorrento, Italy, 1544, into a noble family. He suffered from schizophrenia and was committed to a madhouse for 7 years, but even so, he continued writing love sonnets, plays, epic, and religious poems. It was on this day, 1959, Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun, opened on Broadway with an all-African-American cast, including the young Sidney Poitier. It ran on Broadway for nearly 2 years. And it's the birthday of the writer Douglas Adams, born Cambridge, England, 1952, who, as he was backpacking through Europe at the age of 19, with a book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to Europe, got the idea for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He wrote it up first as a radio series for the BBC, 12 episodes that went on in 1978, about an Englishman named Arthur Dent and his alien friend, Ford Prefect, who hitch a ride from Earth on a passing starship before Earth is destroyed by a band of aliens. It then became a series of comic science fiction novels. Here's a poem for today by John Updike, entitled The Blessing. The room darkened, darkened, until our nakedness became a form of gray. Then the rain came bursting, and we were sheltered, blessed, upheld in a world of elements that held us justified. In all the love I had felt for you before, in all that love, there was no love like that I felt when the rain began. Dim room, enveloping rush, the slenderness of your throat, the blessed slenderness. The Blessing by John Updike, from his collected poems published by Alfred A. Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
And up next on a Juno Afternoon, we have a room full of folks from the Juno Douglas City Museum, starting with Margie Hamburger. I'm going to start with you just because I want to make sure you get people introduced correctly and let people know why you folks came in today and what you're going to talk about.
Great, great. Well, we have our next in a series of our copy and collection series that the museum does about once a month, where we feature something of historical interest or community interest in the museum in a lecture kind of a presentation format. So it's this Saturday. I'll get the logistics out. It's this Saturday from 10:30 to noon, and it's a free program. And we have a wonderful sponsorship of Heritage Coffee, so that's the coffee part of Coffee and Collections. But the collections part this month is based around a book that was just recently republished called Juno Teacher's Tales, and published by the Juno Retired Educators Association. And so that's who my friends are here, because they can talk about the content there. But the book was printed in 1993. And then they've made a new edition with lots of wonderful photos and just kind of updated, and the design is great. And it was partly done with the support of the Juno History Grant, which is a grant that the museum sponsors, and people in the community who have an interesting project and need some funding can apply for, and these folks did, and then that's the result, and they're going to be sharing that.
Why don't you introduce your friends, and we'll learn more about this project.
And I also just want to mention that these particular three are also all volunteers at the museum, so they're extra special. but we have Barb Potter and Marie Darlin and Sue Baxter are here with us today.
And who wants to start here in describing the project and what's involved?
I guess I'll start. And this, I'm Barb Potter, and I'm president of Juno Retired Educators Association. And I also might mention that the original book published in 1993 was also with the help of a grant from the history grant from the Juno Douglas City Museum. And we applied for it, but part of the conditions were that we upgrade it, that we, it was a lot of work to begin with. The interviews were done, and it was all typed. The whole book was typed in Pica.
Ooh,
and then run off.
Back in those days.
Back in those days. And if I were typing it, I'd still be typing it. But anyway, we converted it to Word, which was something even I didn't I've heard the term, but I didn't know what it meant exactly. Anyway, with the help of Alaska Litha, who gave us a lot of advice and suggestions, we converted it to Word. We tried to pick out a print that would be easy to read, since a lot of older people might be reading it, and even younger people that might need larger print. And Sue and Denise Carroll spent hours at the historical library, which were so cooperative, finding pictures of you did the schools, right? No, it was Marie. Marie and Sue did the schools, found the pictures, and there were way more schools here than I ever knew about. And then Denise Carroll and I did look for pictures of teachers, because those were, that was part of the stipulation of the grant, that we spice it up a little bit and modernize it. And so it's, it was a spiral-bound book, and it's now a regular book. And Alaska Litho helped us with the cover, too, and spicing it up. So I'll turn it over to Marie now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the things that they had asked for, our historical committee asked for, was, you know, to have more pictures of more schools and then pictures of the teachers and all, and those are the things that were missing on the first one. And so Sue and I went up and spent a couple different days up there at the at the state library trying to find pictures that we had a few pictures in the original book, but this one we wanted a lot more of schools that I knew existed, which there were no pictures of, you know, at all, that we could find. But they did find them for us. I mean, we said the one thing that was missing when we got through and located all pictures of all the other schools was, I knew there was a school up in at the Ebner Mine up in up at Perseverance. And so as we were going through other pictures and all, they were searching for some of these other things. And they came up with the picture of the Perseverance School up at the Ebner Mine. And it's a picture of the whole mine with all these different buildings and all. And right at the bottom of it, it says that the building in the middle of the picture with
the snow on the roof.
Is the school. That's the first time that in all the years I've gone through a lot of things that I have ever seen a picture of that school, even though I knew it existed. So those were the kinds of things that we were very lucky to find. The one thing that I told them I wanted was a picture of the first Tea Harbor School, and they did find that, which was a barge which was towed up on the beach. And that's where John and Lillian Turner actually taught school the first year they had a Tea Harbor school. Now, this is back in the 30s. And the next year, though, when they came back to teach, they had built them a school and a teacher each. So in 1 year's time of teaching, they had gone from a barge on the beach to a real school. But there were other pictures that we were able to find, too, which were really helpful because we had never really put all of those together. And actually, we did stop with the pictures then with, what, J.D. High?
Yes,
I think that
statehood,
was...
Statehood, yeah.
And statehood, yeah. Yes. So anyway, there are pictures, including Fish Creek School, and as I said, and even the Minfield School. And they used to have a rivalry between Minfield, which was on Lena Point, and Tea Harbor in those years, because those were within a few miles of each other, and it was a long way to town. So anyway, and in Juneau, of course, we had Juneau and Douglas. But still, all that is in the book, and we were really helped a lot by the staff up there in the library spending a lot of time with us trying to find a good picture of whatever school it was that we were still looking for. And so we really did appreciate all of their time and effort, because it really adds to the book.
The book is the stories of the teachers who arrived here to teach in Juneau in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. But as I think about it, Barb told me I had to share this. when I came in the mid-70s, I had a very similar experience. The stories are about how people found community here and how the community reached out to them and how they supported each other in their various living situations. And what I found when I came to teach in 1976 at Capital School is that same community, and the community around Capital School reached out to support the teachers, and those people are still my best and closest friends that I taught with in the 70s.
So I had no idea there were so many schools. I
didn't either.
Yeah. I mean, just this little brief conversation, that I had no clue that there would be all these little pocket schools over the course of the history of town. It makes sense now when I think about it, but without having it brought to my attention. This must be fun. I mean, there's like a research detective thing here. There must be eureka moments when you find a picture and...
That's right.
Well, even looking for the teacher pictures, we went again up to the library, and they brought out stacks of yearbooks. And as we're looking for pictures of the teachers, we're saying, oh, there's a picture of such and such when they were in high school, and they're now, some of them are now retired even, you know. But it was really fun to look at those, but they were just so cooperative and brought out the books. I have to admit, the yearbook 1963 was very helpful for a lot of the teachers that taught in the 50s, because they went into the 60s, and I happen to have one at my house from 1963, and so we found a lot of pictures there. But we found some of the ones from the 30s and the 40s in the different yearbooks, and it was also interesting to see how the yearbooks changed. You know, and they get a little bigger and a little thicker and a little fancier. And as the years progress, they were pretty thin in the beginning. But then how many were in your class?
My class was 37 people that graduated in 1943. But talking about the difference in yearbooks, they used to have back in the 1915, 1916, when my uncle graduated, they had real fancy bound yearbooks. Then later on, as the war came along, and like ours in the 40s, are very, very plain and simple. Mm-hmm. And there were times when it was even debated whether we were going to have a yearbook or not, but we have had every year, which I think is something to really brag about in a way. And then they got a little fancier again. And I haven't seen the very latest, but those of my daughters then were a little, you know, fancier again. But then they were larger classes. They were 200 and some kids. Yeah. So,
well, I've seen a few from the 2000s, and I'm thinking, wow, they're pretty fancy.
Yes, they are, yeah. Really. So it kind of goes along with the times, let's say, as to how these are printed and put together.
Mm-hmm.
But I think another thing, too, and I don't know how it is right now, but most of those yearbooks have been done by the students themselves. And they are really interesting when it gets down to looking at who's working on this and what all went into it. The other thing that's interesting in those is the advertisements.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
You know, you can go back to all the how advertising changed, for one thing. So those are really historical when it comes down to it, too, as are the stories in the book, because teaching in 1930s was very different than teaching even 20 years later.
And Sue, you mentioned community and actually talking about the stories. Pictures tell you so much, but then there are these stories. So you being a relative newcomer by comparison here.
Just barely.
But the stories. Tell people who are interested in this book.
The teachers were met by the superintendent or the assistant superintendent. And they were met at the airport or at the steamship dock, as the case may be. The early ones, of course, at the steamship dock before they came up by airplane. And they were supported in a way that teachers in the 70s were not supported. They were given housing. People gave them food, in some cases furniture. And as you read through these, you recognize the names of the people that are the teachers, but also the people who are the givers and who supported the... So as I read through it, I realize that the same families that were supporting teachers in the 30s were also supporting teachers in the 70s and 80s, just a different generation.
Mm-hmm. Margie, I know we've got another topic, right, to talk about here.
Yeah.
But before we do that, so for as part of the museum program, how does this work? Somebody comes up to the museum. Is this just a connected project to the museum, the book project itself? If I go to the museum today, is the book there on display? Is there give a sense for visitors.
Yeah, and there's kind of a bunch of things kind of intertwined. So one answer is yes, the book is published. People can purchase it, and it is available in the museum as well as other locations. The program, which is grown out of the, kind of the celebration of the publication of the book, that'll be this Saturday, is an opportunity for folks to hear some of those stories told by teachers or by people who maybe knew those people or are connected in some way. So we'll kind of have a program of sharing out and of course, if people want to read more, they can purchase the book. And also people can learn about this progress as was being discussed about how you do research and how you find out these stories and how do you gather that kind of hunt as you were describing. And then the last little piece, too, that is woven in here is this history grant, which, again, we can mention on Saturday or it's on our website. Or people can call if they have a project in mind that maybe needs a little bit of funding that's relating to Juneau history. And we have a granting program. The applications are usually due around the end of June. And, people make proposals for example, a history grant funded the signage at the Mike Pusich Boat Harbor in Douglas. So there's some fairly newer signs about who he was and why that harbor is named after him. That was something that they sought some grant money from. And, of course, the book and things like that. So there's kind of a bunch of different things kind of rolled into one.
Okay. And I don't want to shortchange the other topic. So is there time to go back through one more time and hear about the book?
Sure. Or do you want me to just – I'll just put a tiny little plug because it's really small. I just wanted to let the community know next week at the museum we have a Juneau Explorers program. Next week's spring break for kids from school. And so in the afternoons from 12:30 to 5, if kids want to come and join me at the museum to do some really fun things under the theme of small. And again, they can call the museum at 586-3572 to know about that or about Saturday's program. Visit our website. It's probably best to just Google. And the Juneau Explorers is open to kids ages 6 through 11. And it is that one is fee-based, whereas Saturday's for free.
Okay, well, thanks. So we've got just a couple of minutes. So back to the book, maybe just from each of you, for people who are interested in history and our history here in Juneau, you've already put some really interesting information out for folks, but is there something special about the book for you that you would just put out there for the audience in general as a way to pique their interest and their curiosity about the book?
Well, I came in 1961 for 2 years. My dad was in the Coast Guard, and I had just graduated from college, so I came for the two-year adventure, And I worked at Harborview School, and I looked at going through the book. I thought that teacher was there. There's just all of these teachers that were at the end of their career, really, that were at Harborview when I was just starting. And then I was only there 2 years, and then I became a domestic engineer for several years. And then I went back to teaching again and went back to Harborview and then up to Capitol. But it's amazing how many of those teachers were in that building, but, you know, retired in just a few years after I was there. But I didn't realize how long they had been there. Some of them had come in the 30s, and this was the early 60s. And I just assumed, you know, they taught a few years, and little did I know. So,
well, I think that one thing that's interesting with the book is that anybody that's been here for any number of years will find teachers in there that they knew. And I knew practically all of them, you know, either as my teachers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact then, as you had said, that there were schools in other places. Now, we didn't mention Thane. We didn't mention Treadwell, but it's all in the book.
People have to buy the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. True. To get the rest of the story.
To get the rest of the story, yes. But the thing that, because I can remember teachers being treated as a very important part of the community all the time that I was going through school, let's say, and then became involved with the PTA and then went on the school board for 6 years. So I've been through several different versions of this business of teaching in Juneau. But this is just such a wonderful history of how teachers were a part of the community and a big part of the community during those years. Of course, we were a smaller school and smaller town, and things were just different in those days. So I think that's what has really interested me so much is the history of Juneau that's in that book.
And Sue, we've got maybe a minute.
One last note.
Yeah.
There will be, it's already been mentioned, but there will be relatives of several of the teachers that will be speaking from their perspective at there. And I think that's going to be fascinating, really interesting to me.
Well, thank you very much. We ended up with more time than we thought we were going to have, but now we're running up against the top of the hour here. So we're going to make a transition. So Margie Hamburger and volunteers all from Juneau Douglas City Museum, good luck with the project. The book is fascinating. Thank you for your wonderful work, and thank you for coming into the studio this afternoon.
Thank you for giving us the time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
See you Saturday.
Yes.
Right.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
A lot of soul searching, and it is very hard for him to leave and for us to have him leave. He felt that this was the best way forward.
Ferguson's embattled police chief steps down. It's Wednesday, March 11th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. Coming up, the latest resignation in Ferguson, Missouri, following a scathing report from the Justice Department. And in Madison, Wisconsin, the response to last week's police shooting of an unarmed biracial man. Also this hour, why electric companies worry